Hello and welcome to the Green Room Golf Course podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. Thanks for listening to this podcast, which sheds a light upon the golf industry and what it takes to maintain a modern course. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody. I'm Jim Croxton, CEO for Bigger, and I'd like to welcome you to this Continue to Learn Extra Talking Shop webinar. Today, we bring together the RNA's agronomy team to talk about how the COVID-19 crisis has impacted on their role, the development of the essential maintenance guidelines, what the lockdown has meant for courses, and what to expect in the future. Please feel free, as always, to ask questions using the chat function, which should be located somewhere on your screen. We'll look at those questions as we go through and try and pose as many as we can towards the end of the webinar. Our panel today, you can see on the screen, three members of the RNA's agronomy team. Alistair Beggs, Head of Agronomy, joined the RNA in January 2019, having previously worked as Head of Agronomy at STRI. In his time at STRI, Alistair has advised on many different types of turf throughout the world. Alistair's qualifications include a biology degree and a diploma in golf course architecture. He's a regular contributor to industry publications and presenter at turf conferences, and is also a keen golfer, member at both Royal Liverpool and Rye, and of course Alistair was famously captain of Royal Liverpool in 2014 when a certain Mr. McIlroy won the Open Championship. Richard Windows has been an agronomist for 20 years and has been championship agronomist to the RNA for several Open Championships, the AIG Women's Open, the Amateur Championship and the Walker Cup. He has a passion for links golf and delivering sustainable turf surfaces to the highest standard for championship golf. He's a member of Royal Troon Golf Club, playing off a handicap of 10. And Adam Newton joined the RNA in January 2019 after working previously as senior agronomist at the STRI. He's worked at 5 Open Championships, 2 Women's British Opens and the Walker Cup. He gained a first-class honours degree in turf grass science and received an RNA scholarship, as well as winning both the Baron Brook Turf Science Award and the Martin Jones Award. Adam is a very keen golfer, a good golfer, member of Fulford Golf Club with a handicap of 3. So welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us and spending some time on what is a beautiful day in the UK for those of us with us, the hottest day of the year so far. Alistair, perhaps as a start, would you explain a little bit about the role of your team within the sort of RNA structure?
Thanks, Jim. Hello, everybody. Thanks very much for having us on. It's a great pleasure to be involved in your seminar sessions. Our role at the RNA, it's multifunctional, really. There are a number of different aspects to what we do. Adam and Richard will sort of chip in as I go through these if I've forgotten anything, which I'm sure I will. But our primary function really is to support our host venues, venues that host RNA championships now and into the future. Now that includes boys and girls events, men's and ladies events, professional and amateur events. So when you add all of those up, and you take into account the fact that we're visiting these venues well in advance in many cases, it adds up to somewhere between 150 and 200 visits per annum around the UK and Ireland that we make. And obviously the number of visits we make is dependent upon the championship and what stage we're at in terms of preparing the courses for those championships. So that would be our primary function. We also have an important function in terms of interfacing with Steve Isaac's department, the sustainability department at the RNA, and promoting best practice. I think it's fair to say all three of us passionately believe in best practice management of golf courses. And obviously the interfacing with sustainability involves getting involved with GEO, who are dedicated to providing a credible and practical sustainability system for golf. Their on-course platform, which allows clubs to evaluate and improve and communicate across, the three themes of nature, resources and the community. And then obviously we're part of the process is promoting the Golf Course 2030 initiative, which the RNA set up in 2018, to consider impacts of climate change, resource constraints, so things like water availability, sand availability, and obviously the big issue of regulation, so pesticide availability, into the future. Thirdly, we've made an appointment in recent months. Our colleague Chris Gray joined us out in Singapore. So Chris is head of sustainability and agronomy, based out in Singapore, and deals with the Asia Pacific market. So increasingly, we have more and more contact with Chris. Obviously, Chris is Australian by birth, but did his education in the United States. Has a lot of experience of golf course management, out in Asia, Australia, and the Middle East. So interfacing with him is very important. We can learn from him. Hopefully he can learn a little bit from us and the way we do things out here. We continue to interface with Bob Taylor, who does our ecology work for our venues, which is a really, really important part of what we do. Agronomy and ecology sort of interface, very closely together, particularly at our open venues. So that's an important relationship that we have there. We, in structural terms, we form part of the championship department at the RNA, which is headed up by Johnny Cole Hamilton. And the championship department is charged with delivering our championships. Their time is spent on the Open Championship, of course. But it's been interesting to integrate ourselves into that group of staff, and there are various specialists in there dealing with land, dealing with traffic, dealing with sort of tentage, construction, erection, F&B, all of these things that exist around an Open Championship. So we'll get asked agronomic questions around staging that we deal with. And then also an important part of what we do is sort of, keeping up to date with industry people and the industry as a whole, and working with our partners such as ETL and POGO. So we're using ETL for our soil lab delivery. And we've developed a good relationship with Carmen Magro out in the United States with his POGO system for moisture management. And we're trying to move forward continually with what we do. And then obviously interfacing with the trade and keeping our basis qualifications up to date. So hopefully that provides a reasonable summary of where we're at and what we're up to. Sure, have I forgotten anything there, Adam, Richard?
You covered that well, Alistair.
That was excellent, Alistair. Yeah, very good. And interesting, actually, how many parallels there are with relationships that we have at Bigger. And obviously, we've spoken pretty regularly through this last few months. We'll come on to that shortly. But so many of the people that you've mentioned and the organisations you've mentioned, and for example, Golf Course 2030, a project that we're heavily involved with and hugely supportive of. And in fact, for future reference, there's another webinar of these type on the 4th of August with Steve Isaac from your team at the RNA and Paul Miller from SRUC, discussing the sort of progress in the Golf Course 2030 project. And I don't think pandemics were part of the original scope of Golf Course 2030, but it was telling us we had to look forward to a different future. So it was very much right in that respect. Let's just touch on that. Over the last few months, it's obviously been very different for all of our members and for all of us as Bigger, but I imagine it had a fairly major impact on the agronomy team in terms of your normal operations. And I was certainly surprised to hear just how many visits you would have normally done. What has the crisis kind of meant for you for these first, let's say, 3 months of the crisis?
Well, it essentially meant a huge change of emphasis, really. I mean, we'd have spent a lot of our time during this, well, what's been sort of 10, 12 week lockdown, out on site visiting our venue clubs. We quite simply haven't been able to do that. Safety is paramount, not only for RNA staff, but also for club staff that we'd have been visiting. So we didn't think it was appropriate to be doing that work, nor could we do it because government legislation, as it got tougher, prohibited us from doing that sort of travel. So it's only really in the last two or three weeks that we've been taking one or two baby steps to get back out and meet a few folks and try and get a handle on turf and what's been happening on golf courses. It's been an interesting two or three weeks in itself, and I'm sure between the three of us we'll give you some feedback on what we've seen over recent weeks and the trends that we've viewed. We've had to, during the period, we've had to communicate in different ways, and we were talking before we came on about Zoom calls and Teams, etc., and video conferencing, and I think without that we'd have struggled. I think during the period we've had good communication between the three of us. We've had good communication with our line manager, Grant Moyer, up at St Andrews. And we've had good communication with our championship colleagues up at St Andrews through the team system. So that's worked pretty well. We've also had good communication with our with our host venue guys, and the technology that they have. I'm thinking of things like drones and obviously videos through phones now can give us an insight into what's happening at venues even when we're not there. And the definition we can get through these videos now is quite incredible, even down to the turf level. So we've explored that, and I would like to think that some of these techniques will probably stick with us going forward into the future, which will enable us to be more canny about travelling. I think there will always be a place for site visits and face-to-face dialogue and looking at turf on the ground. But it's been an interesting time. But nonetheless, even though we haven't done the site visits, we've been busy and trying to keep in contact with folks and find out how things have been going.
And we'll come to the essential maintenance and other things a little bit later on. Obviously, there's a lot more to the RNA than just the Open Championship, but it is a big focus for your team. And a few months ago, before this crisis broke out, Alistair, you and I bumped into each other down at Royal St George's, and it was looking absolutely outstanding with just a few months to go. But obviously, that's been, a big wrench. You'll have stayed regularly in contact with Paul and the team down there. How are things looking with perhaps another year to prepare? Does that change things at all?
I suppose it does change things in that as you get progressively closer to an Open Championship, then the level of anticipation builds. And the last time I was down there was when we met. I think that would have been February. So all the communication I've had with Paul since then has been via phone calls or via video conferencing or phone videos. That Paul's been great in terms of communicating with me and keeping me up to speed. In terms of the golf course, well, Paul's a great advocate of best practice, and that is a very, very important site from a golfing perspective, but also from an environmental perspective. It has certain designations, SSSI, SAC, etc. So Paul's very aware of that and manages the site, very carefully, very effectively. It's probably an area of the country that's beginning to be impacted by climate change, possibly more than some other areas, although I think we're all being impacted by it to a certain extent. But as you can imagine, down on that Kent coast, the number of months that grass actually grows down there is quite small. And we joke about the fact that really we don't get much growth from December through until the end of May, because they tend, they get cold temperatures through those early months, and then easterly winds. It then tends to turn red hot in May. And that's not great for growth either. And then you can have periods without any significant rainfall through until August. So sometimes the growth window down there in East Kent is 2 months, and both of them are in the autumn. So we're very conscious of trying to get the golf course in good shape through that autumn period, and then almost nurse it through the winter and the spring to be able to present it for an Open in July. And we were in a good place in February. We genuinely were. We were very pleased with it. Paul was very pleased with it. The club were very pleased with it. So obviously it was hugely disappointing, not just for us, for the club, for the RNA, for the golfing world in general, for the Open to be postponed 12 months. But such is the situation we're currently enduring and living in.
Yeah, and I think in the last few days we've had, I think what's starting to be some heartening news, we're starting to hear about events that if everything goes to plan, are going to take place. I know that's starting to impact on you guys, and probably for Richard and Andrew, some of the events that you were are actually going to take place the rest of the year. How are preparations going for those, bearing in mind that it's been a pretty, I guess, a very different spring for some of those events?
Well, I'll jump in here. I mean, the Women's Open, we're looking forward to staging that down at Royal Troon in August. The course is in great shape. Billy McLaughlin and his team have done a superb job over the last few years and throughout the lockdown, and conducted my first visit, official visit down there a couple of weeks ago, and another one with the club strapped to my back. The course is great, so we're really looking forward to hosting the championship there. Been working hard over the past few years on firming the surfaces and improving sward composition, which have been superbly kind of executed. I suppose kind of, you know, thinking back, the last time I spoke at a bigger event, we were talking about climate change at the Scottish conference. And, you know, Royal Troon's a great example of a club that are sort of taking or acting upon these threats of climate change with upgraded drainage and irrigation systems. And just sort of thinking back to the wet February, the incredibly wet winter, and how that improved drainage system had really helped the golf course. And then coming into a really dry spell of weather through the lockdown, how the enhanced irrigation system was really maintained quality turf condition far more efficiently and effectively than it once did. So all in all, really looking forward to the championship, and the course is in great order.
Excellent, good. And the Northwest has got a bit of golf coming up. I think we've got the Birtdale and West Lancs going to feature later in the season.
Yeah, that's right. I'll let Adam talk a little bit about the amateur championship at Royal Birkdale, and then maybe I'll talk a little bit about the women's amateur at West Lancs.
Yeah, so obviously a recent announcement this week about the amateur championship being solely staged at Royal Birkdale now, rather than being staged by both West Lancs and Birkdale. So Birkdale have got the full week. Alistair and I were there a few weeks ago. The course is in absolutely superb condition. To come out of the lockdown in fine shape. When we were there last, it was fair to say it was underwater in February in certain areas. And you know how the weather had changed since then, but it had coped with a lockdown and a drought in superb condition. And Chris Whittle and his team are all set and ready to go for the amateur championship. I'm very much looking forward to it, and we are too.
Yeah, good. And West Lancs is sort of, it's not necessarily an upgrade, but it's an upgrade in terms of amount of golf that's going to be played that week. It's going to be a different challenge for them.
Yeah, Stuart Hogg and the team there would have had, they'd have had two stroke play qualifying rounds in the practice prior to that. But obviously the women's amateur is now a week's golf. So it's a slightly different way of looking at it. He's very much up for that. Back to just touching on what Adam said. I mean, we focus on the COVID-19 quite rightly, because it's had a huge impact on our industry and every industry. But we forget that February was the wettest February on record in many parts of the country. Mm-hmm. May was then the driest May on record in many parts of the country. So the COVID problems were bookended almost by extreme weather conditions, which, the climatologists tell us we're going to see more and more of going forward. So not only have greenkeeping teams out there had the challenge of dealing with, staff restrictions during this COVID period, but they've had to deal with, extreme weather as well. So to see the courses coming out of this period in good order is particularly pleasing. But yeah, West Lancs is in good shape as well. And, we've got a few weeks now to polish that and polish all the venues to bring them up to standard that we like to present them to for the championships. But when it's polishing, it's easy. You've got good fundamentals in place, which are what we work towards, over many years, which is why, continued input is important really for us. And then once we get nearer to the championship and championship year, then delivering the excellence required, not only for the championship but for members as well, do they demand that these days, is a little bit easier to achieve.
Let's just turn attention back to then the kind of a few months ago when we went into this process. We worked together with you guys very early on at the start of it on the essential maintenance guidelines, which I think was a really important piece of work that helped our industry navigate a very difficult situation. Other industries, even in the turf world, have probably still not found themselves in as good a place as golf managed to get through that time. Thank you, gents, all three of you, for your cooperation and that of the RNA through that important piece of work. Alistair, do you want to talk briefly through sort of the process and some of the thinking behind why we actually sort of ended up doing that piece of work and the importance of it, I think, sort of in a broader sense?
Yeah. Well, I think that the theme that's run through this whole lockdown period is one of unpredictability and difficulty with planning. A lot of the people that are on the call will have experienced producing a plan, and by the time the plan's been produced, the plan's defunct because there's been some more government legislation or something's changed, and you've got to produce another plan. So as we went into this period, I mean, it's all new ground for all of us. Nobody knew what to expect. suddenly we got this virus descending upon us, and we didn't know how that was going to impact on our lives. We didn't know how it was going to impact on golf. We didn't know how it was going to impact on our jobs and on golf course maintenance. So I think as we went into it, you know, our primary objective was to try and develop some sort of system to allow golf courses to continue to be managed in some form, because the ultimate fear was sort of World War II syndrome, in that, you know, golf courses were almost going to be sidelined. They'd be allowed to go fallow. You know, there'd be zero maintenance. And obviously from our point of view, from an R&A perspective, you know, that was a grave concern. And we wanted to try and develop some sort of system that would allow us to undertake at least basic maintenance to keep the courses in some form of condition, so that when we eventually came out of this lockdown period, you know, we'd be able to play golf again, and we'd be able to play golf again on something that, you know, was reasonable to play on. So that was the starting premise, really, and making sure that within that everything that was suggested took health and safety into consideration, because, you know, of paramount importance was the safety of staff, and their well-being. So, you know, things like hygiene and social distancing and you know, all the things that have been developed since, you know, fell into that document as well.
Yeah. Thank you. What do you think of that period of time, and certainly that sort of first 6 weeks when, probably nearly 8 weeks, when golf courses were all closed? I think, you know, practically every course except the ones with very small teams in the first place had a much smaller team managing the golf course, and of course no golf traffic at all. What have been the kind of impacts on golf courses that you've seen throughout that process?
Well, I mean, the impact's been significant. If you bear in mind that clubs, and Adam and Richard will have views here as well, but you know, some clubs, a lot of clubs viewed furloughing and viewed the process of reducing staffing levels differently. So some clubs were more draconian than others. You know, we've heard stories of 18-hole golf courses being almost maintained for periods, short periods, with one person. You know, two people, three people, up to six people, 36-hole facilities being operated or being managed by three or four people. So the impact on that sort of in those early days was simply the guys simply couldn't do much more than mowing, essential mowing. And that first version of essential maintenance, which I think came out on the 26th of March, you know, it was simply focused on mowing and basic irrigation and basic nutrition, and making sure that the machinery that was being used was safe and up to speed. And that we felt at that point that it wasn't fair to you know, to expect guys that were operating with very small teams to do much more than that. Some guys did manage to do much more than that, and it was quite amazing in some cases what they did achieve. And it's amazing, I think, how much more efficient you can be if you haven't got golfers on the golf course. So that was a big factor, and that was a recurring theme, you know, that came through the whole period, and maybe as an industry we can learn from that, the balance between golf and greenkeeping practice. We can probably get better at that as an industry going forward and learn from it. The impacts were were significant. In terms of, obviously, courses were rested, so we got, you know, we've seen, all three of us, we've seen benefits from resting swards, be they on greens, wear areas, wherever they may be. So we've seen stronger swards. We've seen better grasses, because some guys, believe it or not, managed to get some seeding done before the lockdown started, or in the early throes of it, when they still had the manpower available. And we've seen seed germination. I've seen good seed germination on a number of venues. I've seen the last two or three weeks on all areas of the golf course. So the rest had a benefit, and the rest had a benefit from a botanical perspective, but also a general grass coverage perspective. We've seen naturalisation. So, you know, roughs that have been cut on a regular basis no longer being cut, particularly roughs beyond, you know, playing lines largely. And clubs that have worked, I mean, there are a lot of clubs that we've worked with, and I'm sure Adam and Richard will endorse this, lot of the host venue clubs have worked long and hard on their roughs. So we think of golf course, or a lot of golfers think of golf course management as just, you know, maintaining greens, tees and fairways and paths maybe. But, you know, a huge amount of work over the last 10, 15 years has gone into the ecological management of roughs, tree management, heather management, all of these things. And we've seen real benefits to those areas. So carry roughs coming back, but carry roughs coming back, not as penal thickets where you're going to lose balls, but as areas that add definition and interest to the game of golf, but aren't causing people to lose golf balls. Again, that's something we can build on, I think, in the future. So, you know, again, a realization that in some areas, less is more. I think that will stick with us, you know, down the line, and we'll learn from that. And then as I sort of mentioned earlier on, golf type and timings, I think two ball golf, getting around golf courses more quickly, not starting golf too early, so, you know, almost having a curfew. These are all things that, you know, our industry needs to work with golf clubs, you know, to achieve the right balance. I appreciate there's a, you know, there's an income argument to all of this as well. But I think we can get better at these things. And I think, you know, if we communicate better in the future, it'll be good for the game, and it'll be good for greenkeeping, and it'll be good for golf itself. So they would be the main impacts or effects that I've seen on golf courses. I don't know whether Adam and Richard have got anything to add to that.
And Mike, just add to that, you know, certainly many of the links courses up here in Scotland, and, you know, in I live in the south side of Glasgow, that the non-golfing public enjoyed the open spaces of our golf courses kind of really well. And I suppose there was some concern at that point that there was bikes and there was prams and there was whatever going across our picnics and bunkers and things like that. And I guess there was some concern that how are we going to transition back to golf? I mean, that's happened generally, certainly up here in Scotland, really, really well. And I think, you know, the golf club being part of the community and offering their open green space, I think we've made sort of good progress in that regard. And that was a sort of an in, you know, really the non-golfer understanding that a golf course is a nice place to be. So, you know, that was an interesting thing, and how we've transitioned back has been, you know, it's been relatively easy.
Yeah. Adam?
Just to add to that, I mean, you know, sometimes, I mean, it's obviously been an incredibly challenging time for many and still is. But, you know, out of adversity, there can come some opportunities. And I do think that, you know, there's been opportunities for adjusting golfer expectations with some elements of the course management. And bunkers, I think, was, you know, certainly one of them. And Richard and Alistair both touched on that. And I think actually getting back to golf, where obviously we've got no rakes in bunkers at the minute, we've got, you know, different policies being in place at different clubs, but golfers are possibly getting used to seeing bunkers in a less perfect state for a change, which is, you know, which hopefully there'll be some legacy from that. But and you could say the same argument with green speeds. You know, when sort of we first came out of the lockdown, I think golfers were delighted to get back out and playing, and you know, the stint meter was less of a talking point. Well, for one, the bar wasn't open, so that was a helpful helpful part. But yeah, you know, hopefully we can sort of, you know, there might be some sort of positive legacies in those areas of course maintenance.
I really hope you're right, Adam. I think there's obviously been some positives. I mean, things like membership numbers already across the country, we're hearing astonishing reports. A number of people I've spoken to with having joined more than 100 new members since the golf course has opened. You know, how long it will last for, we don't know, but that connection between the golfer and their golf club, and then that opportunity to potentially reset the relationship between the golfer and the golf club. And certainly, I think we've definitely reset in a really positive way the value of greenkeeping, which a number of our members had felt in recent years was becoming taken for granted and becoming very difficult as the golfer expectation outweighed what was possible within budgets, not what was possible scientifically, but what was possible within budgets. And it does seem that, you know, with a few exceptions, generally speaking, golfers are enjoying being out on the golf course, you know, value the opportunity they can do that. And as you rightly say, perhaps a bit less focused on green speed and more focused on, aren't we lucky to be here? And I think that managing that kind of legacy, I think, is going to be really important. I wanted to ask you about, you know, the communication, you work with a lot of the higher profile venues and a lot of people that that have got very good relationships with their managers and their customers. And I did want to ask you if you'd seen sort of good examples of how our members can properly manage expectations, can really be involved in the process to enable them to succeed going forward.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, Jim. Good question. I think, you know, we're fortunate to work with a lot of high caliber course managers, greenkeepers. And I think from my perspective, I don't know whether guys agree, but, you know, being technically competent is very important, you know, in the job that we do. But, you know, greenkeeping is a combination of science and art, and it always will be. It's a bit like the game itself. You know, there's a scientific element to it, but there's an artistic feel element to it as well. But when it comes to being a top course manager, obviously, you know, you have to be good at sort of managing teams and managing men, getting the best out of those teams, motivating them. You've also got to be a very good communicator. And the very best course managers are good communicators. And I think in a time like this, where we're all suffering, you know, from adversity, and, you know, a lot of us have been down in the dumps for a while because of the lockdown and not being able to go out, not being able to play golf, not being able to do our jobs as we would normally see them done. It's almost a time where you need, as a manager, to be more visible. I think the best course managers are visible. They're engagers. They engage with people. Golf clubs are places where somewhere between 400 and 1,000 people will come together at different times to play a sport. And I think being able to engage with those people on a regular basis is a really, really important thing. You can produce your golf course to the highest of standards, but if you don't engage so well with effectively the people that are paying your wages, then there's always going to be a bit of a schism there. And I think if you can work on that, and you can have a good relationship with the you know, with the members, doesn't necessarily mean that you've got to play golf with them, but some, you know, that will work with, you know, for some course managers. But it's finding a way of being visible and connecting with them, whether it's playing golf or whether it's, you know, it's interfacing with them in the clubhouse, being seen around their areas of activity, or whether it's giving, you know, presentations to members in whatever form. There are tools out there now to help guys with that, and I would encourage any youngsters coming into the industry to, yeah, focus on those early years on your technical skills, but always keep your eyes and your ears open, because what you see on the ground is really, really important and is irreplaceable. But developing good communication skills and being able to talk to people, being able to communicate in different ways, and that includes the written word, you do those things well, then you will go far. And as I was going to say, there are certain tools out there now that are available to greenkeepers, including sort of the on-course system that GEO, as part of the GEO system. You know, those sorts of tools are very good for producing infographics and helping to put presentations together, which, you know, can be very compelling these days. And, you know, I suppose agronomy from our perspective over the last 10 years has changed, in that it's probably more fact-based and stat-based than it was, certainly when I started, dare I say it, about 30 years ago, where it was simply a matter of opinion. And now we're trying to sort of integrate the, you know, the feel, the opinion side of it with facts and data. And so the systems that are available to guys to help them with that side of the job, you know, that's important as well. And, it, you know, that all that takes us forward, and hopefully, you know, means that, you know, from our point of view, golf will be, you know, will be thriving in 50 years time, which is our vision.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's probably a good time to turn to sort of the future, because, you know, we think of data is very much the present, but I think the ability to manage our turf and our facilities with that data at hand is going to be, you know, is obviously going to improve, and we don't know quite how quickly. But what do you think are going to be the keys for our members and you guys, I guess? I mean, you know, in trying to sort of drive standards going forwards, what are going to be the areas of modern development that we really see our members embracing in the future?
Okay, well, I'll just mention a couple of things, and I'll maybe come back to sort of Richard and Adam, who were obviously pivotal in the process of changing what we do, or what we've done over the last 10 years in terms of data integration into our systems and into our reporting. In terms of technologies moving forward, I think the most important thing that I would say, particularly to younger greenkeepers, but to all greenkeepers and course managers, is, you know, be aware of the technologies. That's important. You know, we live in a changing world. As human beings, we don't tend to like change, and it's easy to shy away from that. Before you can change, you've got to be aware of what's available to enable you to change and enable you to do your job better. It's all about marginal gains, and it's all about doing things slightly better. Even if you think you're very good at something, you can still be better at it. So it's having that mindset, I suppose, to be able to develop yourself, develop your staff, to do things better. If we think of sort of, you know, tangible elements to technologies that can move greenkeeping forward, well, if we talk drones, I mean, drones are an obvious one. Some of your members, Jim, even have sort of drone licenses now, and, you know, are sending us brilliant videos of their golf courses and fly-throughs, which are, you know, really useful to us, and almost give us a perspective on golf courses that we don't get from walking around it. So that sort of thing's brilliant. And obviously, as the cameras improve and NVDI technology improves, we can get sort of stress pictures back from turf and this sort of thing. I think moisture management is moving forward very, very rapidly. So the techniques that we've got available for measuring moisture on greens and the importance of that, you know, increasingly we see that as a very, very important part of what we do. Not only in terms of optimizing turf conditioning, but also, in terms of suppressing disease and managing, you know, turf quality. How we deal with water, how we store water, how we attenuate water, perhaps becoming self-sufficient of water. There are still a lot of clubs out there that use mains water, and probably, you know, 30, 40, 50 years time, it might even be a shorter time frame than that, you know, we may not have access to mains water. So we need to think as golf clubs, about how we use water, how we store water, being as efficient as possible with it, and having a system on golf courses that is functional in terms of delivering it, because that's another big problem. A lot of our irrigation systems at golf clubs are 30, 40, 50 years old in some cases. And that makes it very, very difficult for the guys to cope with these extreme periods of drought that the climatologists are telling us we're going to have more and more of. And the same applies to drainage, interestingly, in that a lot of the drainage on our courses is Victorian. You know, it's 100 years old, it's blocked up with tree roots, it's dysfunctional. Clubs won't chop trees down. The tree roots block the drains. So there's a major problem around drainage as well. But the difficulty there is the challenge is that those two areas, drainage and irrigation, are big capital costs for clubs to put right. And it's a difficult time for them to be doing that, which we all understand. What else? GPS. You know, GPS is having an impact on all our lives. It'll have an impact on greenkeeping as well going forward, be that in respect of spraying or be that in respect of mowing. It may well be, I think, that, you know, 20, 30 years time, you know, guys might spend less time sitting on mowers mowing grass. Doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, jobs in greenkeeping will reduce. There'll be other opportunities that come out of that. You know, these systems go wrong. These systems have to be managed. So there'll be new jobs, new opportunities that come out of the technology that comes to the fore over the next 20 or 30 years. And it's about being aware of that, and it's about embracing it, really. We need to embrace that as an industry. We need to embrace it as individuals. You need to embrace it, and the folks that are listening need to embrace it as well.
Yeah, just sort of add to that, I suppose, that, you know, to highlight or illustrate the evolution of how agronomy and greenkeeping has changed over the last 10 years. If you think about 10 years ago, how many people or courses had a moisture meter? There was probably very few. Now, you know, that we saw the evolution of clubs getting a moisture meter. Now they're moving into sort of moisture mapping, and now ourselves at our open venues, each of our venues have got a pogo, and we're getting live data about the moisture values of the Open Championship venue sat in our office, and that's sort of a highlight. And I suppose another thing about organic matter testing, I think very few before 2008 in the UK and Ireland were measuring organic matter using sort of loss and ignition. Now that's, you know, it's a common part of sort of greenkeeping language, and that is now moving on. We're sort of doing more detailed sort of intact core analysis of trying to understand more about the soil physics of our sort of championship venues to, you know, drill down and heighten performance, reduce inputs yet further just by managing that soil system far more accurately. Because that's one of the big challenges in one of the City Golf Course 2030 projects is how we're going to manage our playing surfaces with potentially less sand going forward. That's, you know, that's one of the big challenges over the next maybe 20, 30 years, how we retain that quality of surface firmness, manage organic matter with a potentially sort of dwindling resource. You know, we collectively as an industry have to work out how we're going to try and do that going forward. And more science is only going to help that, really.
Yeah. And just going back to Alice's point about the water, we know that, Richard, you're more concerned with north of the border, but in England, our data suggests that up to 60% of courses are still reliant on mains water for the majority, if not all, of their course irrigation, which is a really worrying statistic when you look at the vagaries of the weather we're having. 2018 is not that long ago, and we've already had a month of May here that looked like we were going to be in real difficulty. We've had a bit of a wet spell since, but that moisture management, I think, for our members and I think if nothing else, this last few months are going to force every golf club to have a real good look at their kind of longer term business plan and look at some of those capital projects around irrigation, drainage, what's actually important to their business. I'd never say that they shouldn't invest in the classic locker rooms and clubhouses, whatever. But, you know, the golf industry's had a really good month without anybody being able to go into a clubhouse, which has, I think, proven what we at Bigger would have said all along, that really it's a game based around the turf and actually playing on that. Sorry, I jumped in, Adam. Any thoughts on kind of the future of greenkeeping?
No, I just wanted to make one point about, I think one of the key aspects of the future undoubtedly is ongoing education and it's knowledge. And I think as a global industry, excuse me, as a global industry, we've never been more knowledgeable or professional or educated. And I think, you know, you yourself, Jim, and Bigger have got a lot to thank for that, for BTME and the sort of the education side of things. And it's getting better and better. And I think we'll continue to do so. But I do think, you know, training and education for everybody is a fundamental part of understanding how we take our golf courses forward.
Yeah, I agree, and it's obviously clearly a focus for us, and it's this crisis forced us to have a look at how we deliver our activity. These webinars are something we were going to look to do anyway, but they were accelerated very quickly by the fact that we couldn't actually go out and hold local seminars. And you guys have spoken at many things for us over the years. We've got a few kind of questions coming in, and one or two that have come in from before the webinar through our website. There's been a question which I wanted to address anyway around the kind of the currency of essential maintenance. Let's all hope that we're not seeing a second spike or a return to lockdown measures, but we're reminded by the politicians that all of these measures are current and things could change. Would I be right in saying that basically the maintenance guidelines remain sort of under review, such that if we have to go back to different practices in order to maintain safety, we will do so?
Yeah, good question, Jim. I think that's certainly true. I don't think any of us can sit here today and say, right, this virus is on its way out. I think that's far from the case, unfortunately. I think we all hope that there won't be a second wave, and we all hope that, you know, the numbers are low enough for, for it to slowly dwindle and not cause us too many more problems. But, you know, we can't say that. So we need to be, I suppose the term is be prepared for whatever eventuality may come, going forward. Let's hope that we can have a positive period now. Certainly, down here in England, clubs are beginning to return to some form of competitive golf, or are about to. and you know, Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland will, you know, will follow undoubtedly in due course. So yeah, I think we need to have an open mind. We need to do what we can now. We always need to have sort of safety in the back of our mind and make sure that what we do is safe. I think there will be challenges around that if the virus doesn't go away, and that we then enter sort of periods of weather where, you know, it's not as good as it is now, and you know, we get rainy days and stuff. And I'm very conscious that, you know, the facilities at some clubs will be challenging in that respect, and it will, you know, it will be difficult for guys to, you know, to undertake any necessary social distancing and work rotas around. You know, health and safety. But you know, that may be something that we have to do, and if we have to do that, Jim, we'll be back on another one of these, and we'll be looking at version 4 of essential maintenance. Yeah,
well, and one thing I'd add on that, it's been a privilege of the last few months to sit in a number of meetings that I probably didn't expect to be, one of which has been a regular meeting with the parliamentary group for golf, which a number of your colleagues also sit on, and the parliamentarians on that group have two things really. First of all, they've been hugely pleased with how golf has been united throughout this. All the organisations came together and spoke with one voice, which has meant that we have had in return from them very good response in terms of how golf can behave. We found out back on March the 24th, if you like, I think it was, that the DCMS said that they believed that maintenance could take place if we could kind of detail what essential maintenance was, and within 2 days that had been done. A number of sports had no guidance for nearly a month because golf was able to provide this sort of united front. And in recent terms, when lockdown measures have eased, we've received, you know, information from the sports ministry in England, certainly. I think it's followed on in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland very quickly what that means for golf. And I think that's a product of the fact that golf has managed itself very well throughout the piece. And I'm pleased to say so many of our members and their employers have kind of towed the line throughout this and put safety first. So I hope, obviously, that we can just continue to go through this in an improving world. But if it does deteriorate again, I feel confident that golf is in a good place to respond well with government and within the guidelines. There's one or two kind of hospital passes here. I think we've had a couple of questions come in around the control of worms, and I don't think I'd be amazed if any of you three guys has got the solution, because nobody's come across it yet. But is it something that's concerning you in terms of championship agronomy?
Yes. You know, one of the areas you haven't really discussed this afternoon is legislative change and the impact that's having on the industry. And you know, again, if I go back 30 years, I mean, what we had access to in those days was unbelievable in terms of, you know, pesticides. Not that that was good. You know, I think we've moved forward dramatically in that period of time. And I think where we are now is absolutely right. I think things will get tougher over the next 10 years. And the way we deal with disease, the way we deal with pests, you know, be they worms or leather jackets, chafers, you know, we're just going to have to adapt to, you know, to dealing with these things. There will undoubtedly be some new technologies coming along, hopefully, which will help us. But I think collectively we see the management of these pests and diseases now as very much a layered process. You know, there are various stages to it. So we, you know, in terms of disease, we still have fungicides, but you know, we need to use those, you know, a lot more carefully. We need to use them differently, because the actives that we now have work in different ways from the ones that we had before. You know, for many, many years, we relied on contact fungicides like iprodione that would just put fire out whenever you got the fire. Now, you know, we've got to think about, well, when are we likely to get the fire? And we've almost got to apply a fungicide to healthy turf, which is against, you know, it's against the fundamental principles of some guys that probably grew up in my generation, where we were told never to put a fungicide on turf unless, you know, there was disease there. So that's a fundamental sort of mindset change that needs to be embraced. But we've got to think about, you know, we've got to think about moisture management, dew control. You know, we've got to think about using plant elicitors like potassium phosphate to, you know, to help fungicides work better. We've got to think about using magnesium sulfate, iron sulfate in more creative ways. We've got to use forecasting apps too. We've got to get better at forecasting when problems might occur. And I think if we do all of those things, ultimately will do those things intuitively. You know, the next generation of greenkeepers will do that intuitively and will become very good at it. But at the moment, we're in that process of change where, you know, we have to just look at things in slightly different ways. And, you know, that's a challenge for all of us. On the worm one, well, you know, it's difficult. We know that it's worms feed on organic matter. Where you have higher levels of organic matter, you're going to get more worm activity. On the back of worm activity, you get weeds. That equals turf deterioration and a problem. So how do we deal with worms? Well, I mean, it's organic matter reduction. It's surface acidification, really. They're the two tools that we have available to us at the moment that will control worms in a safe and healthy way. I don't know whether Richard or Adam have got anything to add to that.
It goes back to that sort of layered approach, though, doesn't it? That, you know, it potentially, as you say, organic matter reduction, so clipping removal, maybe sand top dressing. But, you know, there's a challenge because where's the sand coming from? It's interesting that you do see sort of less worm casting in areas of sort of high fescue content. That's fairly anecdotal. So is it a sward change kind of thing, certainly on sort of fairways? And I mean, it's not always possible everywhere, but there's certainly, it's not a spray and get rid of worms type job anymore. It's much more of a kind of a layered, multifaceted approach. And even then, we're still going to have worm populations at certain times of the year.
Yeah. Anything to add on the hospital pass of worms, Adam?
No, Richard stole my points about boxing off clippings and sanding, but and obviously the sort of the association with greater resources to implement those things. So no, not much more to add other than it is a very challenging situation, worm casting, particularly for the inland guys on sort of heavier soils. I do think that a big part of these kind of issues, again going back to sort of education, but this time for the golfers, you know, there has to be a greater acceptance of, you know, issues like worm casting on golf courses. The sad reality is we're not going to have the tools that we once had that would eradicate such problems. So again, you know, communicating to the golfer is, I think, is fundamental, really.
Yeah.
One area, Jim, that's possibly, you know, exciting is sort of, you know, endophyte technology. I'm not aware of any endophytes that can control worms, but there are certainly endophytes out there that can control insect populations. So, you know, these are fungi and fungal exudates that are associated with certain root systems of certain types of grass. And there's certainly some scientific evidence out there that, you know, certain grasses can control populations of leather jackets and chafer grubs potentially. So that's possibly an exciting area through grass breeding that might gain traction for us over the coming years.
I knew there'd be a point in this webinar when the technical language went over my head, and we just got there right there towards the end, Alistair. So thank you for that. I was kind of keeping up until endophytes and exudates came along, and then I just kind of glazed over. But I know many of our audience will have understood what you meant by that. One question we have had in, which I don't think I'm going to be unfair and send in your direction, but I'll make a comment myself as sort of around the furloughing that's gone on around golf, about the golf clubs of this country. The furlough scheme, as we know, is going to last through to the end of October if people want to take advantage of that. And people asking whether or not, in light of golfer expectations and staff still being on furlough, what I would say, every club is in a different position. You mentioned at the start, I think, Alistair, in one of your comments, that you know, some of the higher end clubs, higher budget clubs, that people would maybe automatically assume are more insured in this kind of situation, have a much larger reliance on the tourism income and green fee income and broader income than just member golf, and so they are struggling. And some of the smaller budget clubs actually are coming through this okay. We are still seeing substantial furloughing. Our survey recently suggested that clubs were still, on average, had 1.9 members of greenkeeping staff furloughed. Which means you're looking at 70 hours a week of greenkeeping work not taking place, you know, which has to have an impact on standards, particularly in light of the fact that golf courses are very, very busy. We were asked in the same question around Have we got any examples of clubs managing that balance between golfer and greenkeeping? And there are a lot of examples of clubs doing what Richard, you said earlier in the conversation, you know, a later first tee off time than perhaps we've been used to. In some cases, you know, one morning a week where it's even later to give the guys a chance to get out and do some more windows within the week. But the main thing that seems to have been around the greenkeepers and the management team of the golf club working together to manage expectation. And I think we've got a little bit of an issue coming at some clubs where they've been able to do very little in the way of renovation work during the last few months, and particularly now golfers on the golf course. And we're going to have to go through probably the majority of the summer without that taking place and maybe cram more work into the winter months and we'll see what goes on. But the key, I think, is communicating. We mentioned beforehand, our members need to communicate with their employers and their golfers so that golfers understand that currently the priority is making that first tee available for play and doing what's necessary and not a great deal more, because there just simply isn't the room to do it. Is there any sort of closing comments from you guys that you want to make before we wrap this up?
No, I'd just like to thank you, Jim, and the team at Bigger for giving us the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. You know, challenging times for all of us, but there are positives and there are opportunities that'll come out of this. So we need to be positive as an industry and move forward. And we at the RNA look forward to helping you do that. And you know, we look forward to staging our championships and providing people with some joy and some enjoyment in the in the months ahead.
Thanks, Alistair. Appreciate that. Thanks, Adam and Richard as well, for your input. And thank you all for joining us. We hope you see us again soon. For details of further webinars, please check the What's On page of the Bigger website. Thank you.
The Green Room Golf Course podcast is produced by myself, Carl Hansel, on behalf of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. For questions, comments and concerns, you can get in touch with me by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. You can also join the conversation on social media using @greenroombigger. And we've also got a Facebook page where all the latest notices, news releases and information from Bigger can be found. We're also on Instagram using @bigger_HQ. Subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding they will have about the hard work of Bigger members and other greenkeepers. And speaking of Bigger membership, if you're inspired by what you hear to progress your career in greenkeeping, then a major first step is signing up to the association. The opportunities for career development are countless and potentially life-changing, such as volunteer opportunities at major tournaments and educational opportunities across Europe and the USA. Don't forget, if you're a golfer and you've got any questions about anything you hear on the podcast, have a conversation with the greenkeepers at your club. They've got the expertise to explain what's happening at the course and how it fits into the team's long-term vision to improve playability and enjoyment of the facility.